The story of the Odyssey and Iliad, with which we are concerned this evening, is obviously too long and involved to permit a detailed analysis of all of the elements. Therefore, we prefer to hope that we can give certain basic keys by which the meaning of this ancient and ingenious fable and may be brought more clearly to our understanding. It was probably compiled or prepared, or at least reduced to some type of order, by the poet Homer, a person of uncertain date, who is believed to have flourished in the 9th century before the Christian era. It is only fair to note that we are without general knowledge of the state of the religions of the Greek area at the time of Homer. This was at least 300 years or more before the beginning of that great age of Greek learning, led by Pythagoras and followed by the great Pythagorean successors, Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, and the Neoplatonists. Thus we have largely our knowledge or opinion of Greek religion from the writings of Homer and one or two other early fragments. There is a popular story that Homer was blind. This apparently was doubted, however, as early as the time of Plato. For already an effort had been made to understand the inner meaning of this account. And the philosophers of the Platonic school and those of the Neoplatonic favored the idea that Homer's blindness was symbolical, that it indicated not his inability to see on the objective level, but that he had voluntarily turned his sight inward to the contemplation of those things normally invisible. And that his blindness, like the later story of the blinding of the Cyclops, should not be accepted as a literal infirmity. Yet he was above or transcended the normal state of man's sight and sense, seems to have been implied in this account. We also know that we deal with idiom and with policies and prevailing opinions of a generation and time too remote for our analysis. So we cannot be dogmatic. We can only speculate upon this subject. There is reason to believe that the great Orphic tradition of Greece had developed and was beginning to take dominance as early as the day of Homer. We know that at that time, these rites or ceremonies, now called Orphic, were particularly sacred and secret, and that the general mass of the people had no knowledge of what went on in these initiation ceremonies. It is conceivable, therefore, that Homer could have been one of the earliest to attempt a revelation of these mysteries through a highly allegorical and symbolical poem. Olympiodorus, in his Scholia on Plato, already points out that the fables of Homer should be considered as having a secret and mystical meaning. Here again, we must pause, for we have two possible solutions to this mystery. One is that Homer was in possession of a knowledge not generally accessible to the Greeks of his time, a knowledge, however, which was in itself in not all things perfect, inasmuch as Homer seemed to be without awareness of many of the great later teachings of the Greek philosophers. For example, he was not aware of the rising doctrine of immortality as it came to be a dominant in the classical period of Greek thought. It is also possible that the later Greeks interpreted into the writings of Homer by a fortuitous method of reasoning and interpretation. There is, of course, always a twofold solution to this enigma. In the first place, the legends and fables of the Odyssey, an Iliad, may have been in circulation as folklore long before the time of Homer. Folklore, as we realize, is a kind of waking dreaming of the folk, or of popular collective consciousness. Psychologically, therefore, nearly all ancient legends arise from the internal experience of the individual. Therefore, whether he knows it or not, whether he is aware of this fact or not, his storytelling, particularly when it is derived from earlier sources, is very likely to be highly psychological. The second possibility is that these poems and writings drew out of their interpreters certain secret knowledge locked within the minds and hearts of the interpreters rather than in the original work. I have observed this on many occasions in more modern studies, namely that the meanings of things become brighter and greater according to the light from within ourselves. Thus, poems which were not consciously intended to have a message may release a message from the psychic life of the reader of the poem. In any event, by one direction or another, the great poems of Homer gradually came to be considered part of the esoteric literature of the Greeks. And by degrees, these poems were interpreted and unfolded to come to their final and most complete restatement or elucidation or interpretation in the works of the Neoplatonists. These men, by their own naturally mystic inclinations, found mysticism in all things. And because they were convinced that there was a common denominator to human knowledge, they sought this in all the writings of ancient peoples and were able to give lucid and reasonable interpretations to these old stories. In the study of the works of Homer, we must work largely from fragments, even in the Neoplatonic literature. Occasionally, the subject is drawn in, perhaps most fully and completely, but still in an exceedingly fragmentary state, in the writings of Porphyry. Here we have his Cave of the Nymphs, which is a study in one small symbol derived from the Homeric cycle. Here also we have him calling upon the works of others of his own group and school in building a general survey of the basic meaning of the Homeric stories. We cannot, however, say that he exhausts it or even that he gives us an adequate working text. But we can use from him certain material, adding to it other extracts from Plotinus and some material from Iamblichus on the Mysteries, and a considerable amount from the legitimate disciples of the Platonic school and the original group, including Plato and his nephew, Speusippus. All these together give us some general picture. I do not think it practical in the brief time that we have to attempt to isolate the sources of the various fragments of the story. It would burden us with constant cross-references. So out of the general picture, we have tried to draw a broad pattern, the elements of which can be variously sustained in different works, but the general combination consistent with the known beliefs and opinions of the Platonists and Neoplatonists. Now we have some terms and problems arise which have great interest to us at this time, because there is perhaps no group of fables to which a more completely psychological explanation has been offered. From the writings of these early commentators and interpreters, we are fully aware that they had a broad and deep concept concerning the nature of the human soul, a concept perhaps more adequate than what we have today. But because it is obscured in myth and legend, it remains yet to be revealed or released to the general knowledge of mankind. Sometime this must be done, because it is going to give us answers to a number of problems, particularly in the structure of man's mental and emotional life, problems which have not yet been adequately approached. So we will introduce, first of all, the character of Ulysses himself, or Odysseus, as he is in the Greek. And we will try to understand something about him and his place in the great cycle of legend in which he is the principal heroic figure. We know, of course, that this entire work, much as the other great classical and epical poems, the sagas and Eddas of the world, is essentially a hero cycle. As Carlyle points out, we are dealing basically with the hero or heroic myth. Yet the word hero to us can be applied to almost anyone, from an outstanding football player to an outstanding modern jazz crooner. The term hero is very broad today. It covers almost anything by which we are distinguished or extinguished from the rest. But in the Greek use of the word, as it was in classical times, a very strict and definite definition is implied. A definition which probably is without general usage at all today. The word hero by the Greeks was bestowed as a term or name for an order of souls, having a distinct and complete identity, separate from other souls. Thus we have in their concept of the orders of nature, three particular orders of interest to mankind. These are the human allotment, as it was called, the heroic allotment, and the divine allotment. The human allotment had to do with ordinary and general humanity. The human allotment consisted of individuals who, in their various activities, were living and dying without a driving or natural or inherent purpose. The hero was a combination of the demigod and the superman. But the hero was regarded as a race or kind completely apart from man, as different from humanity as the angels of theology. He was a different kind of being. He was not merely a man who had accomplished some outstanding example of bravery or courage. He was of an order separate, a different genera. He was a creature, so that you could say of him he was either human or heroic. And you had two distinct types of creature, types of being. Yet in the Greek mythology and symbolical philosophy, the race or order of heroes was like unto human beings in most conditions. Heroes could meet and mingle with mortals, and like certain demigods, possessed both divine and human attributes. Thus the hero might appear in society and might live an apparently normal life, but he belonged to a different polity, as the Greeks called it. The inclination of the pole of his psychic axis was different from that of humanity. That is one of the ways in which they expressed it. But it meant actually that as the temperature, flora, and fauna of a planet is determined by the inclination of its axis, so a different inclination would cause a different planetary environment, and a different kind of life would flourish upon it. This is the basic thinking. Now, above the heroic order was the divine order. The divine order, again, an allotment, which in this case had no relation directly with humanity in the sense of any common origin or destiny. The divine allotment was a race of beings inhabiting heaven. The human allotment, a race of beings inhabiting the earth. And the heroic allotment, a race of beings inhabiting a middle distance between heaven and earth. Or, as one of the Rosicrucian mystics of the 17th century, referring to the heroes or the adepts, said, they live in the suburbs of heaven. In other words, they have their own peculiar sphere. You can almost think of it in the terms of Dante, where we have the lower sphere, the purgatorio, rather the inferno, the middle sphere, the purgatorio, and the higher sphere, the paradiso. Well, in the purgatorio would abide the heroic order between heaven and earth, between a divine and mortal state. And the word purgatorio would give us the clue to it, because it means purging. and purging represented the cathartic discipline of the Greek rites, of mysteries, and of purification. Now the heroic souls, having been established then as a kind of life apart, what distinguishes them from ordinary human beings as far as motivation and basic energy is concerned? According to the Greek concept, the hero is a person or a human being who has at some time, either in the present life or in a preceding life, made the final commitment of his consciousness to the process of growth. In other words, it was the dedicated person who had already seen the star and set his course toward it. This course might be slow and might be one of great difficulty and time, but in the hero, the wheels of life have reversed their motion, and whether he has gone far or only a little way, he is returning to his father's house. In other words, he has consciously consecrated himself to growth. He is no longer living merely to the gratification of the whims and passing fancies of external life. He has a motion, a pressure, a dynamic within himself by which he is being moved throughout all of the ensuing cycles of his existence in a direct and positive motion toward the fulfillment of his essential destiny. This, then, would be the simplest basic definition of the heroic state. Now, as we approach the story of Ulysses, we come to another division that has to be immediately recognized also, namely that the Greeks represented or recognized three kinds or steps or levels in the heroic department of existence. They therefore classified their heroes as pertaining to a Jupiterian, Neptunian, or Plutonian allotment. In other words, there were three kinds of heroes. And we learn from the opening parts of the Odyssey that Ulysses was a hero of the Neptunian allotment. In other words, his great adventure, his struggle, everything practically concerned with him has to do with the sea. He is making a long water journey. And when it seems that he is almost going to be victorious, then Neptune, the god of the sea, turns upon him and attempts to destroy him. Ulysses, then, is said to belong to the Neptunian allotment or polity of the heroic order. This means that Ulysses was a hero of only moderate attainments. For in the actual description or discussion of the heroic state, the Plutonian hero is one whose achievements relate only to excellence on the material level of life. In other words, the conscientious, the dedicated, the truly well-intentioned statesman or warrior, the great general who is fighting for a cause he believes and for the good of his people, but must necessarily use destructive means, may account for a certain lower level of heroic effort, because he is a hero as far as his own understanding permits, and he is certainly divided from that mass of human beings who will fight and run. He is not going to fail in his purpose. He may give his life for his country. He is giving everything that he has and knows. Therefore, he is entitled, under certain conditions, on certain levels of attainment, to be considered as belonging to the Plutonian order of heroes. This is the lowest of the allotments. Now, the Neptunian hero is the second allotment. And in this allotment, according to Olympiodorus, is to be included those who by their heroism save themselves. Now this is a rather interesting and rather complicated pattern, but it gradually evolves. You'll remember in the story of Ulysses, he alone finally reaches home. He is unable to save his companions. Therefore, he achieves in himself a certain heroic destiny But in this destiny, he has the gravest difficulties in accomplishing his own salvation, and he is unable to contribute to the salvation of others. This causes him to be considered of the Neptunian allotment, for other reasons which we will also mention. Now, the highest, or the Jupiterian allotment of heroes, the highest order of heroic souls, is composed of those who, by their heroism, contribute to the preservation, redemption, and illumination of others. This was the highest order of the heroes. And Plato and his commentators, describing this, allot such persons as Hercules to the higher order of heroes. Also Pythagoras, and many of the great scholars and leaders and sages and teachers, because they achieved not only their own enlightenment, but contributed to the general enlightenment of others, and caused other souls to enter into the path of heroism. Therefore, the great world teachers and sages and saints and prophets and patriarchs, who not only helped themselves, but led their peoples to a higher level of integrities, they would be considered of the greater order of heroes. So these were the three allotments which were recognized at that particular time. These allotments, again, bring into consideration three levels which are related also to the heroic state. We've already mentioned in Neoplatonism and the concatenation or ladder of ascending powers, values, virtues, and things of that nature. The Greeks assigned to the three orders of heroes also three orders of powers, of which the lowest order, or the Plutonian heroes, were moved by the power of opinion. Those of the Neptunian order by the power of sense. And those of the Jupiterian order by the power of imagination. So we have three powers here peculiar to these orders of heroes. And we learn from this assignment that Ulysses was a hero on the level of the power of sense. Therefore, we begin to see that the entire story of his journey has to do with the problem of sensation, and with the development of the sensory perceptions of man, and the conflict between the sensory perceptions and the internal psychic instincts. Thus we have, to a degree, given you an orientation on Ulysses, what he actually represents in the fable. Is a soul that has already been dedicated to the path of progress, that he belongs on the level of the god Neptune. Therefore, that his problem carries with it the level of sense, and that this level of sense, in turn, implies generation. In other words, Neptune, or the principle of water, is the principle of generation. And Heraclitus declared that souls wish not to become involved in generation must remain dry. Because the moment the soul is involved in humidity, it drinks of the waters of Lethe and falls into illusion. Therefore, the problem on the level of sense involves the problem of illusion, or the elements of water, which the ancients recognized as a reflector. And by its constant inconstancy, its eternal motions, and its being caused to appear as storms and as various miracles upon the surface, yet the depths of it always mysterious and unchangeable. The Greeks decided that it was a symbol of sensation and a symbol of the emotional sphere of man, which could so easily be riled upon its surfaces, and yet the depths of which could not even be explored. So we have this orientation on Ulysses. Now the second point that is probably important to us is to consider the land of Troy. And the land of Troy, which was the home of the Trojans, and no aspersions against any of our local universities is intended. The land of Troy was originally the land of Ilium, over which ruled old King Priam and all his glories and his powers. The word Ilium comes from Elus, which means slime or mud. It is the primordial ooze, the mysterious substance from which life originated in the beginning, as we find in the Phoenician history of Sankarniathon. It is therefore the primitive matter, the ilium. And in the story as it is unfolded by Homer, Troy is the symbol of matter. It is the symbol of the material bodies of things, their forms and natures and all that have to do with these matters. In the story as it is told, you would naturally expect the Grecians, who invented the fable, to be favorable to themselves in the interpretation of its meaning. Therefore, the Grecians, representing their country as a philosophic state or as a great intellectual world, regarded their expedition against Troy as being the symbol or proper symbolism of an expedition of the mind against matter. They held that it was the conflict between intelligibles or internal knowables represented on the intuitive level and the material or external life of the individual. Thus the struggle was that between mental energy and form, the struggle of life and matter, spirit and matter, the struggle of soul and body, or whatever polarity you wish to consider. Now the subject of this little difficulty that occurred in the times of Homer was Helen, or Helene, Helena, the moon, a lunar divinity who is said to have been of the order of Venus. Now Venus and Helen, who was her more or less objectification, is described by the Neoplatonists as the symbol of intelligible beauty. Now, we've discussed in our last evening's discussion something of Plotinus on the beautiful. So we should begin to understand the concept of beauty as it was understood by these philosophers. Helen, therefore, does not represent mortal beauty, but the archetype or the pattern of the beautiful. This pattern, which is captured by matter and rescued by mind, the two armies which struggle for control in the story of the Trojan War. Therefore, Helen is archetypal order, or archetypal natural manifestation, the geometry of the universe, the inevitable harmony of the essential laws of the universe themselves. These laws are taken away or abducted or are placed in a material situation in which their beauty, their wonders, their sublimity, their integrity, and their justice are no longer noticeable, visible, or acceptable. Therefore, an expedition led by the mind is sent forth to rescue man's understanding of these principles. And we have, as Plato points out, a very good analogy in the simple fact that through understanding, man discovers the beauty of God. Therefore, understanding, or the intelligible power represented by the Greeks, must rescue Helen, essential beauty, from captivity to matter, or to materialism, and the concept that all things are to be measured by their external or apparent parts, rather than by their qualities. After the war is over, the various expeditions, or powers, or faculties, return by various courses to their own lands, having accomplished the ends. But you will remember that as the result of the war, the Greeks themselves began to quarrel over Helen. Having rescued beauty, they began to argue and struggle over it, to divide it, to variously interpret it, and in one way or another to destroy the very power which they had originally rescued. Thus we see the mind, by its critical attitudes, gradually destroying the very beauty or truth which it seeks to discover. The analogies as they unfold are very apt, and whether Homer so designed it or not is of little difference. the fact that it can be rationally deduced from these circumstances cannot be denied. Now we must also bear in mind that Ulysses was under the patronage of two powers, one more or less regularly assisting him, and the other appearing or cooperating only in matters of great emergency. His natal or essential protecting god was Mercury. And Mercury, as the messenger of the gods and as the symbol of intellect, was constantly assisting him to extricate himself from difficult or even tragic circumstances. But when intercession of a superior nature was necessary in some great emergency that arose, then Minerva appeared as Pallas Athena and as a superior deity, representing the positive polarities of intuitional understanding, the highest type of the intellect, far higher than mind. Therefore, Minerva, or inspiration, or the power of divine mind, was an emergency available to him. From the time of the end of the war itself, to the return of Ulysses to his own far distant native land, we have a story which is the Odyssey of man himself, the great story, the great tragedy of man. And in estimating the various elements of it, we will try to point out a few of the outstanding symbols, because these symbols become increasingly luminous as we proceed. Our hero is therefore one who has achieved to the middle order of heroes. He has achieved to the challenge or power of the sensory universe, and his entire adventure or experience relates to the gradual dominion over sense and the release and directing of the next higher faculty, which is creative imagination, or, as the ancients considered it, the beginning of the intuitive or inspirational power. He would not achieve fully to this, but when he reached his native land, where he would find the shrine and symbol of his aged father, he would then be ready to be elevated toward unity with the higher order of heroes, the Jupiterian allotment, which was concerned primarily with the highest forms of intuitive inspiration. He was returning to claim a larger destiny, which he had to earn through victory over the limitations of his own nature. Now, the sensory world, as it was understood and known to the Greek philosophers, was a world which resulted in the polarization of the psychic nature in a middle distance between a spiritual and a material state. In other words, in a strangely symbolical meaning, the Greeks recognized that the hero was almost the true human being, but that man, as he knows himself now, cannot truly be human until he is born again through the mystery of the heroic attainment. Thus, the hero represents the integrated human person in whom the psychic nature is in equilibrium. To attain this equilibrium, the psychic nature must resolve its own conflict and achieve a moderation within itself. This moderation is achieved through disciplines. And these disciplines are either cathartic disciplines or those disciplines for the complete and positive possession of the internal nature itself. Ulysses, having achieved the potential power of attaining psychic equilibrium, must then find himself suspended like the line in Faust, "Twixt heaven and earth, dominion wielding." Since, according to the ancient fable, is that which draws man downward into an objectivity or causes him to be bound by matter. Sense, therefore, is the flowing of energy or of the libido toward objectivity and toward the embracing of the objective world. As Narcissus, seeing his shadow in the pool, sought to embrace it, fell and was drowned. That power by which the psychic nature is caused to ascend or rise toward the gods is the theurgic power of the soul, that power which causes it to verge away from matter and towards divine things, and that to achieve this, the internal faculties of consciousness must be awakened. Between these two extremes, or inclinations toward motion, is the equilibrium of the soul itself in its proper state, or in its most natural and suitable state for man, that is, in a middle distance, in which it may still have certain association with matter, but also has a certain association with the divine world. Now here we introduce another group of characters who become very interesting to us out of mythology, and they are called the Sirens. Now, poor Ulysses had a great deal of trouble with them before he got through with his strange and wonderful journeys. But according to this theology, the Sirens are also divisible into three orders, because each one represents the call of energy to a level. The human being living on a psychic level of integration is tempted by one order of Sirens to fall into materiality. And these Siren powers, therefore, represent a peculiar gravitational pull toward matter present in the psychic life of the individual. They are the allurements of the senses. They are not separate beings, but they are a psychic energy within man by which the senses are stimulated and are caused to gravitate toward objectivity. The second order of Sirens release a similar energy on the psychic plane itself, causing the being to pull toward psychic integration, to be lured toward normalcy by another series of stimulations to faculties and powers of his own nature. The third order is that which lures him toward the divine state. And this again is the result of the excitation of certain faculties and powers of his own nature, and the energies by which these excitations on various levels are caused and maintained were called Sirens by the Greeks. We can tell, for example, also something that has to do with other principles. Nymphs appear, particularly in the train of Circe. And these nymphs represent elemental factors or forces, particularly related to the bodybuilding activities of psychic energy. Therefore, in the cave of the nymphs, we find them weaving a magnificent brocaded garment in royal purple upon a loom of stone, and using all of their skill in a most curious and remarkable way. They are doing this within a cave which has two entrances, or an entrance and an exit. And this cave is polarized to the north and south rather than to the east and west. And the two entrances are under the constellations of Capricorn and Cancer, signifying birth and death. In this cave, which was Porphyry's cave of the nymphs, according to Porphyry and his own interpretation, based upon other Platonic sources, he says that it is known to these people that these nymphs represented the agencies which weave or spin the intricate structure of the human body upon the loom of bones, the skeleton, and that the purple vestment represents the arterial and fleshy system which is woven by the elemental powers to cover and adorn the bones or the basic body principle of man. That this partly takes place within a cave, the womb, and other parts of it take place in that larger cave, the Trophonian den, represented by the material life of man, for as Plato points out, human beings live in a cave and are afraid to look out and see what is outside. Therefore, the material world itself is regarded as a cavern, and of course, as we have already seen from its Plutonian allotment, was the underworld. The underworld being actually the sphere of existence in which we live until we make the heroic decision and begin to escape from the mysterious web of circumstance or the mysterious power of body woven in threads of red and purple upon the loom of stone. All of these things have their special and particular meaning. And Ulysses, to escape the evils of various enchantments, carries a moly branch in his hand, a little plant or leaf anciently used in the initiation rites, and signifying by its own meaning and its own substance the power of enlightened faith. For where faith abides, the individual has the strength and inspiration to rescue himself from difficult and tragic circumstances. Now we have two other points that we want to cover, and that is to discuss briefly something that is also in Iamblichus on the Mysteries, but which we could not and did not attempt to cover in the original lecture on that, but we need some of it tonight in connection with Ulysses. And that is that, as the ancient Egyptian priest says, each human being that comes into the world brings with him two powers or two natures, which are called the essential and the natural daemon. Now, our word demon comes from daemon, but it does not have the same meaning. A daemon is actually a spirit. We remember, of course, the daemon of Socrates, the mysterious being that accompanied him and gave him warnings and saved him on numerous occasions. Socrates referred to this daemon as his god. And it was only in the common practice of the early church, which took practically every ancient name that was used in the religions of pagan peoples and changed these names into some demoniacal attribute. It was part of this general effort to discredit the ancient religions that has resulted in many of our present terms involved in medieval demonism, especially the term daemon, but there are others. For instance, in the medieval time, the prince of devils was called Beelzebub. The word is simply Baal-Zebub, which means in Babylonian, my lord who sings, and was a name of the god Baal, and is closely associated with the two figures in the Egyptian desert, which we call the singing Memnon. They have to do with the voice, the sweet voice of the god Baal in the ancient Babylonian mythology. Pandemonium, of course, which is another word we did ill to, simply means the dominions of the god Pan. And Pan was not by any means an evil spirit, but a nature god, a shepherd, and one who had to do with the normal and natural problems of husbandry and of life in general, of marriage, fertility, and things of that nature. Thus Pan became the prototype of our modern devil, but had no such meaning in ancient times. In the same way, Lucifer, Lux Pharaoh, the light bearer, was part of the original story of Prometheus. All of these stories and fables have changed with our beliefs, and demon is one of the words that has gotten into trouble. But in the original meaning, it simply meant an attending spirit. It was not some evil being like the Mephistopheles of Faust. The natal daemon, according to the Egyptians and the Neoplatonists, was much like what the church later called the guardian angel. And we know by a study of church theology that the doctrine of the guardian angel is not canonical, but it has certain precedents and certain privileges because it is said to be of the mind of the church. In other words, it is acceptable, but not a compulsory doctrine. But the guardian angel, or the idea of a protecting spirit that comes into the world with us, was of course heavily known and believed by ancient peoples. The essential daemon, as distinguished from the natal daemon, represented a higher power, a power that remained aloof and separate from the particular life of the individual, but continued with him throughout all lives and into eternity. The essential daemon and the natal daemon, therefore, were described by Plotinus and the other Neoplatonists as those parts of the soul. The natal daemon, that part of the soul which extends into incarnation or embodiment, and the essential daemon, the oversoul of Emerson, or the anthropos, the part which does not become involved in body. And, of course, in the interpretation of Ulysses, it is stated that in the advanced stages of the heroic state, the essential daemon and the natal daemon are reunited and become one, and are no longer separate, because those parts of the soul which extend into body regain their awareness of their own essential origin and are once more conscious of the essential daemon or oversoul. Now, in the story of Ulysses, we come upon an interesting example of the study of the natal daemon on the heroic level. Now, the soul flowing into corporeal existence, staggering, according to the description given by Peleus in his fable of Cupid and Psyche, loses its natural and beautiful motion and becomes, as it were, intoxicated. It has taken upon itself the waters of Lethe, and soul has entered into body as into a prison. And the body, as Plato says, has become the sepulcher of the soul. Or as the same philosopher describes in another place, the soul is locked within the body as the oyster is locked within its shell. It is therefore the belief, or was the belief, that the soul, verging toward body, mingling its essences with objectivity, becomes in this manner intoxicated, or loses awareness of its own essential nature, and it becomes soul in body. Now, soul in body, intoxicated and deprived of its essential essence, or essential substance, not only becomes the slave of body, but becomes to a certain degree, in a mysterious way, the tormentor of bodies. The soul, seeking a restoration of its own superiority, becomes a tyrant over body. And from those parts of the soul which are embodied, emerge the sensory perceptions in the Greek system. For the sensory perceptions are all maintained, sustained, and supported by the psychic energy within the individual. These sensory perceptions, therefore, convey objectivity to the psychic embodied center. And this psychic embodied center, deprived of its own life, deprived of its own realization of its source or root, blinded and distorted by matter, sets up an isolated kingdom of desire, so that the embodied soul becomes the servant of desire, and from desire and the testimony of the sense perceptions arises the chemistry of selfishness, anger, hate, fear, lust, greed, passion, and finally death. Thus, the psychic part embodied within form becomes, in the life of the individual, an eternal source of temptation. And yet, because the energy of the soul is tremendously more powerful than that of the body, it racks the body, it tears the body, it is uncontrollable by the body, and it apparently is forever seeking the discomforting and destruction of the body, not primarily because it wishes to destroy, but because it wishes to be free. And the only way that it can be free is by in some way destroying the house in which it lives. Now, we can take this thinking and carry it into the field of abnormal psychology and do a number of interesting things with it. It has a great deal of importance for us. So what do we have? We have this tyrannical soul centered through its tremendous power of the sensory perception. And we have this attempting to bar the progress of Ulysses on his journey home. So, the embodied soul, or the so-called natal daemon, becomes the cyclop, or the one-eyed giant. The one-eyed giant, because the soul's function through the body is by means of the endocrine gangliated system, particularly the third eye in the brain, by means of which the psychic energy both receives and distributes the testimony of the sensory perceptions. Thus, the one-eyed giant is symbolized by the cyclop, and sometimes represented in the ancient drawings as inverted, is so placed that the head or the eye of the cyclop corresponds with the location of the third eye in the body, and the body of the cyclop inverted so that his feet are upward. In other words, representing a being existing in another world, or of another nature or kind, walking on air instead of earth, but joined to man by the mysterious power of this psychic center or eye. Now man, living in the world of sense, in order to escape from the power of the cyclop, drives the stake into its eye. In other words, it blinds or removes the power of the sensory perceptions to control the psychic energy. This is presumably the same thought that was used in reference to Homer himself, that this blinding of the cyclop represented the individual breaking the tie by means of which his internal life is left to the machinations of the testimonies of the outer or external sense perceptions. It is part, then, of the overcoming of the sphere of sense. Perhaps in another way, perhaps not in the same symbolism, but involving the use of the eye, but in a contrary manner, we have the story in the Bible of the eye is single, and the body is filled with light, attempting to describe the necessity for overcoming the polarity of sight. In other words, the concept of good and bad. The Greeks, however, represented this by a cathartic discipline, by means of which they purged the body of its dependence upon the testimony of the senses, represented by the eyes. This thought leads us again, of course, to another very interesting problem. We are told that the essential daemon in the hero or the higher estate as man proceeds is restored to unity, and man has an overlife, an internal life, which is above sense and which he must call upon when he has certain extreme need. Therefore, the oversoul or the psychic overself undoubtedly does have an order or allotment belonging to Minerva, the symbol of the total or complete power of the apperceptive intuitional faculties of man. The next point that we want to bring out particularly is to enlarge upon this problem of the relation of sensory perception to the project in hand. This we have to do something more elaborate with to make it clear. We are in, again, the same symbolical situation exactly as we have in Buddhism. In Buddhism, we have the problem of illusion and reality. The cyclopean eye that is put out is the eye of illusion, which is darkened. The individual, therefore, rescuing consciousness from objectivity and illusional attachments. But we learn from the general story that Ulysses is still torn by the sensory perceptions, and that under certain temptations, when all else fails, he binds himself to the central mast of his ship in order that he cannot be lured away or cannot fail. This is the same mast of the ship of Dionysus around which the grapevine grew in the older legends of the Dionysiac rites. This represents stability, central polarization, the establishment of the life in moderation and in security, what would be equivalent in the Eastern system to seating oneself in meditation and remaining in the center, to prevent the scattering of the forces and resources of consciousness. In other words, drawing all available power to a center and becoming immovable. And this mast of the ship, of course, represents the pole of the world, and represents the axis of consciousness itself. So Ulysses binds himself to this ship. Now the ship itself, of course, has many interesting meanings. It is the ship of the doctrine of Buddhism, and it is the ancient ship of Christianity, the little vessel which is still shown upon the papal ring, the ring of Peter. This ship is, of course, not only the doctrine, but in the old system, it represented the mysteries, the institutions, the sacred doctrine itself, by which all souls are carried home. It is therefore, of course, the security of the revealed rites, the ancient institutions, by means of which the preservation and security of man is guaranteed. And binding himself to the doctrine, binding himself absolutely to the laws of the teaching and philosophy in which he was living, he gains the strength to withstand the various temptations and allurements. Now at one time in his wanderings, Ulysses comes to the land of the Lotus Eaters. And there he has one of his most interesting experiences. This land of the Lotus Eaters is a place where there is almost complete forgetfulness, and the individuals live forever in a state of continuous pleasure. Of course, the land of the Lotus Eaters represents the illusion of the continuance of happiness in a state of ignorance. It represents the tendency of men to forget by taking the mysterious nectar of the strange trees that grow in this area, and in so doing become oblivious to all the mysteries of life.